I mean, I've got a lot of wisdom to share.
That's true.
I mean, you know, I am a solid C with bursts of B type preacher. So
yeah.
Hi, friends, and welcome back to SermonSmith, a bi-weekly conversation about the craft of sermon preparation, and my name is John Chandler. Now, about what I just said, I said this is a bi-weekly conversation, but this month only I'm experimenting with doing one podcast every week. I had a few already lined up, and so I thought I'd give it a try and see if that is a pace that I can sustain. This is still a bi-weekly conversation, but for this month, there will be a new interview every week, and we'll see. And then maybe magically sometime soon, we will change it to a weekly conversation about the craft of sermon preparation. My guest today is a friend of mine, someone I've known for several years, have a lot of respect for. It's Jim Pace. Jim is a pastor at NLCF, which is a campus church at Virginia Tech. You'll hear me stumble all through that as he and I get started, but Jim is someone I've enjoyed. We run in the same circles. We're both part of the Ecclesia Network. So it was fun to have this conversation with him and hear what I think is an approach that's a little unique to some of the others. So I hope that you'll enjoy it, benefit from it. Our partner for this episode is Audible Audiobooks. I love audiobooks. I consider it part of my own sermon prep as I listen to it. I thought since I'm talking about Audible, I'll give you a recommendation for an audiobook that I really enjoyed. If you're considering it or thinking about getting started with audiobooks, one that I read a few years ago that probably I read, that I listened to, but that's reading it, right? That I listened to a few years ago that has really stood out for me is Unbroken by Laura Hillenbrand. It is, you know, just been released here in this last month as a movie, but the audiobook was fantastic. There is probably no audiobook I've listened to that better engaged my brain, my ears, all of, you know, just all of the imagery that came to life as I followed that story. I find that narrative structure works best for audiobooks. So I would definitely recommend Unbroken for that. If you want to get that book or any other for free and you're not already a member of Audible, you can go to audibletrial.com/sermonsmith. And that way they'll recognize that you're supporting our show. And at the same time, you'll get a free book. You will sign up, but it's basically a free book. And then if you don't want to continue with any kind of subscription after that, you can just cancel and you can keep that book for free. I listen on my iPhone, but it's also easy to listen on other devices as well. So that said, let's move on to our conversation with Jim. Well, with me today is Jim Pace, and Jim is the pastor of...
one of the pastors.
This is a great introduction already. Jim is one of the...
You didn't even get through a sentence.
No, man. And this is going to tape. We're using this. Jim,
right.
Obviously, Jim and I know each other from how this is going already. Yeah. So, but here's where I got hung up, because Jim is, one of the pastors at NLCF, which is what you always call it. I know that stands for New Life Christian Fellowship, right?
That's right.
Do you ever say that, or is it always NLCF?
No, it actually depends on what you're talking about. Our church has two congregations. The name of the church is New Life Christian Fellowship. NLCF has been the historic name that the congregation that is more focused on the university side of things has had. So it's been the thing that we've kind of been known by for 25 years. So we go by NLCF, and our congregation that's more multi-generational, focuses on the community, goes by New Life. So it's really... it's my own lack of clarity at times. I will refer to the church by the name of the congregation. So,
I just learned this, and I've known you for like 7 years.
I know. Well, it's a tightly guarded secret.
Yeah.
Well, so this is kind of a big deal for me to open up. So
yeah, it's
I'm feeling rather exposed right now.
So I should, this is the longest explanation or introduction of the name of a church in SermonSmith history. But we haven't even talked about the city, which would be Blacksburg, Virginia.
That's right.
Which is the home of Virginia Tech University.
It's the home of Virginia Tech, not Virginia Tech University.
It's not Virginia Tech. We're editing that out because now I look foolish.
That's right.
All the rest I don't care.
it's home of Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University, known as Virginia Tech.
Okay. So Virginia Tech University. All right. Well, Jim, it's fun to have you on here, obviously. I'm already having a good time. And we've already covered in the pre-show that you are a solid C preacher with bursts of B.
Solid C.
I'm looking forward to hearing then some of your wisdom. So let's talk a little bit more. Tell us a little bit about NLCF. You've said it's a campus church, but talk a little bit more just about what's unique about being at a campus church and the context you're in.
Yeah, you know, I don't know in terms of what's unique. Our story is a little bit backward in that we were our church was planted by J.R. Woodward 25 years ago, and it was planted as an on-campus college student-focused church that has over the years evolved, grown, broadened, and it was a big move when we technically began to focus also on off-campus students, and so it just kind of has grown from there. And then from there, 6 or 7 years ago, we planted a more multi-generational community congregation off of ourselves. So it's kind of the inverse of what is typically done. But we have been trying to be a presence here at Virginia Tech. I tell people that I feel like we're surrounded by highly intelligent cynics. You know, that's kind of these are my people. And I've been here for almost 19 years and have loved it.
And it's all that said, for the sake of our conversation about sermon prep and preaching, most or all of your preaching is at the campus congregation, right?
It is now, yes. We the two congregations have developed their own teaching teams, and so yes, I will occasionally speak at New Life at our intergenerational congregation, but I almost all of it is on the college side.
And how often do you preach for the NLCF?
Well, we follow the academic calendar, so we kind of think about things in terms of semesters. In a semester, there are 16 weeks, and I will do this semester, I'll do 6 to 7 of those. Sometimes I've done more. There have been seasons where I've done 75% of the teaching, seasons where I've done 50. We have some really gifted teachers here, and so I really like the opportunity to give them time to speak and let them kind of talk about, proclaim the gospel from their perspective, their voice, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And so you just teased my next question without even knowing you were teasing my next question. What is the, because you just used the word proclaim, talk about teach. what in the life of NLCF, what role does the sermon play?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think it's probably, it's less than some pastor friends that I have and more than other pastor friends that I have. I guess that's probably the easiest way for me to explain it. It's this is where you can see the C coming out. I think a B guy would have a better explanation and an A guy would have something you could tweet. But I think sometimes the sermon is seen as it is really the worship is the build up to it. It's the main event. And we do not have that perspective. It's not the main event. But then I have other friends that are in churches where there's almost no focus on the public proclaiming of the word, or rather, I mean, the word is valuable there. The teaching of it is valuable, but they lower it to the point where it's almost indistinguishable from other things. And so I would say we kind of sit somewhere in between. I think it's a terribly important time where you have the ability to, as you've sensed the move of the Spirit, to speak God's words to his people and to try to help them to get a sense of a broader vision for what God is wanting them to do, a means by which they can live that out, a greater understanding of how the gospel interacts with their life, you know, encouragement, the whole thing. So that's the best way, I think, in terms of continuums. And I think it's less than some and more than others in terms of the focus of it.
Yeah. Do you think there's a higher, whether for better or for worse, I don't know, but do you think there's a higher premium or higher expectation on the sermon from the congregation since they're so used to hearing lectures? I mean, do they place a higher emphasis on spoken word in a setting like that?
Well, I think there certainly can be. I think there is a higher focus on kind of the cognitive side of relating to God and understanding God. The students that are here at Tech now, Tech is not an easy place to get into, even though J.R. Briggs may argue that point. So that the students that are here are used to having to work hard to understand the things that they're interacting with, have seen a lot of success in doing that, and are people that can figure out what they need to figure out. So when you're trying to walk together with Christ and towards Christ, and there's certainly things that you can grab, and there's certainly things that are beyond your grasp. I think it presents a challenge in that way. So I think they probably lean towards spoken word, but I think what they probably lean towards even more than that is the ability to understand whatever is being placed in front of you.
Gotcha. And how do you, you talked about how you develop other teachers?
Or yes.
You didn't talk about how you develop them. You talk about how you have other teachers. I assumed you develop them within the congregation.
Yes,
is that accurate?
Do.
Okay.
So it is.
What's that process look like?
Well, you know, one of the images, a lot has changed with NLCF and with our church over the years. But one of the things that has really been the same, and it was one of the first things I noticed even when I first started coming, when JR was here, was it the idea that this should be a teaching hospital, that this is a place where we don't focus on necessarily the person that is always going to be the best, most polished, most experienced, doing the most of whatever it is that they're doing. We really try to focus on helping people develop their gifts and then to give them a chance to learn through experience and discipleship how to use them for the church, both for when they're here and for when they move on to the other places. I mean, our sending capacity here is huge because the majority of people in Blacksburg don't stay in Blacksburg their whole life. Hmm. And so we just really start. We've always been a place that is, in fact, I was in a fairly long meeting today where a key focus of our time was, okay, who are the people that we're seeing these different gifts in, and how do we give them a chance to take the next step in developing those gifts, and then how do we try to read how that's going, and how do you do that from there? So we give people, we try to understand people's gifts as quickly as we can, then we try to give them opportunity on a smaller scale to walk in them, and we kind of walk through that with them, and then we just kind of follow the fruit and see, well, all right, how does it go? What are we noticing? What does the Spirit seem to be saying to us? What are other people sensing? And then we just build from there, and teaching is like anything else to do with that.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing. I mean, you're a training ground for tomorrow's church leaders.
Yeah.
Being in a church where there's probably more grace towards leaders and training, because everybody's at that stage of life.
Well, it does help, yes.
Yeah. Well, talk then about how you plan. You described how really the church operates with the academic calendar, and so you basically have two blocks. How do you plan out your sermons? How far in advance do you do that?
Well, what we do is I'll tell you what we like to do.
That's good.
And That's right. And then I can tell you what actually happens. When we are looking at what we're going to be teaching, we tend to look semester to semester. And then depending on the year, our general practice has been we bring all three of our services into New Life. You know, our church meets three different times on Sunday, and we bring that into the New Life gathering time during the summer or during school breaks. But so if we're looking at this spring, we started a series on 1 Corinthians in the fall. And so we're continuing that. And the way that we figure out what we're going to do is we talk to our leaders. We talk to people that have just started coming. We look back at the last, I usually try to look back at the last two or three years of what have we talked about? What are the things that we focused on? We try to, we're living life in community. So you run into things, you hear things, you notice things. We spend a good deal of time in prayer, and then we bring our teaching team together, and we just kind of scattershot initially. What are we thinking? And we start to look for clusters, and we start to look for, okay, are we maybe sensing similar things and using different words? Are we sensing different things? And then we'll just, once we've done that, we take more time to pray. And we just really try to ask God to give us a sense of clarity. That's one part where in terms of the value of the sermon, I think the prayer that we put into it shows our sense of value on it. We really want to try to be in sync with what the Spirit is trying to say to His people. And so that can mean that we'll do, this year we're doing the first, I mean, we've never done a two semester long series before, but we're doing that because we sense that's what He was saying. Sometimes they'll be topical, and there'll be a few series that'll be 2 or 3 weeks. Usually every semester, so twice a year at least, we try to slow down and go through a book, a letter, something. So it really kind of depends year to year. But that's the general way that we look at it.
And what breakdown would you say of that would be topical versus like working through a particular text?
That's a really good question. I'd say in the last few years, I'm terrible with questions like that. It would probably be 50-50.
Yeah.
This year, it's been 100-0. Even though, you know, 1 Corinthians, we've even broken 1 Corinthians down into the topics that Paul is taking the church in Corinth through. We've even taken that and kind of tried to help people see what is the cultural narrative that he's dealing with, what is the truth he's trying to bring through it, that kind of thing. So
as I think about 1 Corinthians, it almost sounds like Paul's writing to a college campus anyway.
Well, I tell you what, I mean, I look at it and I think, yeah, I can see that. Yeah, that'd be nice if that didn't happen too. So I won't say that there's no overlay. It was a raucous ride for the church in the first century.
Sure. Well, then let's talk about your role, or not your role, but your process particularly, you know, on one of those weeks that you know you're going to preach. How far in advance do you get into it? I mean, it sounds like with you preaching about 50% of the time, ideally you can stretch out your prep a little bit. I don't know if it works out for you that way among other responsibilities, but just talk about what's a timeline for how you prepare any given sermon?
It does shift a little bit. What I try to do is when I know the particular teachings that I'm going to do, and it really is nice to have a team. I have obviously a lot of friends
you have a lot of friends.
I do. Just wanted to put that out there. Please don't edit that part out. I have a lot of friends that they really do 80, 90, 100% of the sermon load. And I've never had to do that. And that's just been an incredible blessing. So what I do is when I, when we're trying to kind of think through the topic, even before we've landed on it officially, you're doing some thinking and reading and reflecting. You're kind of just doing all that as a part of the discernment. Then once that gets figured out, then when I know the particular topics that I'm going to be dealing with, the sections and whatnot, I mean, I'll start working on those in some cases a couple weeks out, and in some cases a few months, depending on where it happens to fall on the calendar. And then I try to have my talks done a week early. That prior to this semester hasn't happened very well, but this semester we're shifting things so that all the teachers are going to have their talks done 2 weeks early. Hmm. So I try to aim towards having that, just so I can have time. I need to talk it out. I mean, I need to have a room where no one can hear me, where I can, I just talk out the talk, and then I argue with myself. And is that what he's trying to say? Are we pushing too far? What's this? And from that talking, the outline shapes, and then from that outline, the content shapes. And so mine is sometimes a little more labor intensive than some people that can just kind of sit down, excuse me, pull it all together in their head and just start typing. It takes more time for me.
So you really write your sermon by talking. Really? It sounds
like... I'm sorry, you broke up on me there.
If I understood what you just said, you for the most part write your sermon by talking out loud and helping that clarify what you're thinking.
Yes, that's how I mean, I'm an external processor, and so yeah. For me to sit down and just type it, my thinking is less clear. And so yeah, it's my preference is to just get somewhere where I can talk and have a whiteboard, and I just write and argue, and yeah, that's what I do.
I would like to watch this. Yeah. So I mean, where in that process, talk about how this, I mean, that sounds like that's the process of putting the actual sermon itself together. Where are the elements before, like that, that's mm-hmm. where you get your reasoning and your content and your structure and your outline. Where in your process does sermon or study and exegetical work and all that come into right. play? Do you talk first and then start working some of that stuff in, or how does all that come together?
No, what I try to do is I try to take everything that I'm going to be teaching on in a semester, and I try to just do my study and whatnot. I have usually an intensive period of study that might be a week or two, and I'm not just doing that. I wish I could, but there's just no way. But where I will really try to dive as deep as I can into the text itself. I remember hearing from a professor years ago that he never taught a passage unless he'd read it 50 times. And that's something that's just stuck with me. And I don't have a clicker. And, you know, at 38, I'm not ready, but at 50, I am. But I really try to just read and read and read and read, and then jump back and jump forward and just ask different questions of it. And so that for me, because I usually will have I'll do 2 or 3 weeks together, and then I'll have 3 or 4 weeks where I'm not. During that time is when I will really try to kind of prepare for that next cluster of teaching. So the timeline kind of varies based on travel and
yeah.
family and things that are going on within the church. But I do have that period where I just am kind of dug in, and I try to not go to commentaries or other books until I almost can recite the passage. I try not to go to those other people's thoughts too quickly, but then I really value some of those resources that I've been able to find over the years. And there are certain ones that I just always want to know, what are they thinking? And am I lining up, or am I in some sort of weird theological stream that isn't going to take us anywhere good. And so that's when I bring in commentaries. I look at some language stuff. I try to get a broader picture. And then just the general reading that I do on the general topics that the text is dealing with also kind of bleeds in there as well.
Yeah. Is it? So I'm going to backtrack on that. As you talk about how you read it over and over again, I mean, you said obviously you don't have a clicker, but do you feel like you certainly get to a point where you're, I have enough clarity on this, I'm ready to move on to the next, maybe not, maybe clarity is not the right word, but do you feel like there's some kind of internal mechanism that clicks over that says, I'm familiar enough with this now, or have some sense of this enough now to move on?
Yeah, there's usually, keeping in mind that there are times when my schedule doesn't permit, and I just have to go with it because I need to prepare it. And I just ask the Lord for an extra measure of grace and beg people to forgive me. But yes, if I have sufficient time and, to do it, there really is, there's kind of a sense that, I mean, so much of what you do as a pastor, and you know this, is you kind of have a, hopefully, a God-guided gut. There's not an enormous number of parts of your role as pastor that you can say, well, I know this step for this long leads to this step for this long leads to this. You learn how to notice when it seems like the Spirit is saying, there you go. That's good.
Yeah.
And so I would say there's in general a sense that, okay, I understand this text. I understand. I feel like I'm in it. There are times if it's a more difficult text, I'll go to some of the websites that let you print it off without any verse numbers or, you know, the little paragraph descriptors or anything. And just, I feel like I'm sufficiently immersed in it that I get it. Hmm. At least to the extent that I can. And that's usually, you know, usually when I start to move forward, all things being in their perfect order.
And so then when you get to the study stage, what are some of your go-tos resource-wise?
Oh, you know, I'm like probably one or two other people that you have interviewed for this. I'm an N.T. Wright fan. I like to know I have his commentaries on the New Testament.
Yeah, the Fair Everyone series.
Yeah, the Tom. Old Tom.
Tom.
So I really enjoy those. I like some old school. I like to know Matthew Henry's reflections. You know, he's someone that that matters to me. I will go back. I have some resources where I can get into some of what the early church fathers have thought. If I can, I like to sample kind of a broad range of perspectives. And a lot, you know, that so much of your perspective is determined by the era that you live. And so I like hitting different eras to see, okay, how have they interacted with this text? And, you know, how is that built? How is that adjusted? How has that changed? So those are some that I will go through. And usually by the time I've done that, I can feel like the talk is it's kind of fomenting in my head. And then it's that's a burst of B right there. it's starting to kind of, it almost feels like it's kind of wanting to bust out. And so that's when I start talking and then I begin arguing with myself and that kind of stuff.
And how much time is that?
I mean, gosh, that's a really hard thing. I'd say on a week that I'm doing a teaching, when I'm preparing it for whatever, I mean, that's probably, I'll spend 12 hours that week.
Just talking?
The talking stage to having the outline ready, to send to the PowerPoint people and all this. And then that also includes, it might be more, because I also on Sunday, when I'm teaching, I come very early to our office. I mean, I'll get here like at 5 in the morning and I'll just go over it. I don't have a lot of notes when I teach. I don't know. I don't feel like I can connect with what I'm trying to say and the people I'm talking to. So I tend to I don't memorize it, but I know it. And so I like to continue going over it, and I'll still be making shifts and changes and additions and deletions and all that. And so it's probably 12 to 15 hours if I can. That's my ideal. There are plenty of times where it's less than that because I just don't have the time.
So you're locked in a room with a whiteboard, perhaps a straitjacket, I'm not sure, but but you're doing the talking out part and scrawling all over the whiteboard. So what does the process look like to take that onto paper? Do you then take that and I wouldn't take you to be a manuscript guy at all. Do you then take that and then just put it into a pretty simple outline?
It depends. It really depends on the talk. When I wrote the book a few years ago, it was, you know, I had to, obviously that, you know, the manuscript is actually a manuscript.
Right.
And so,
right.
And so I think that if the more theologically complicated or the more difficult it's going to be received by our people, then I will go to writing it out. More as a clarifier for my thinking. But I never take a word for word manuscript with me when I teach. I just can't seem to do that.
Yeah.
Usually it will be a really, really blown up outline where it's like, okay, this, then this, then this. Does this work? And that whiteboard will, there'll be lines and, you know, I'll be crossing things out and moving things around until I get what feels like a thought line that at least makes sense to me. And then hopefully to one or two other people as well.
And what is your primary source of illustrations?
It really kind of depends. I mean, I'm a parent, I've got three teenagers. So what does that not deal with? And, so there's that. I think that I read a lot, and so I will get things from other authors. My own life, things that I've done, or a lot of the things that I talk about. I noticed something that, and this is kind of a given in other churches, but ours, it was a little different. We had the first kids in our church. No one had been married before Trace and I were, and no one had any kids. And when I became a dad in this church, people started to respond to me differently. And it really was like I was something other than what they were. And it was, you know, these are my people. These are, you know, and so I started to use self-deprecating humor to kind of even that out a little bit. And so I'll crack on myself. There's plenty of things I do that are just that dumb that it seems to work out. But you know, I'll do, it just kind of depends. It's whatever I've interacted with most recently that seems to make sense in the context of what we're talking about. Talk about world events. We'll talk whatever it is.
And you said a little bit ago, you read a lot. And
I do.
Do you have a process for, even as you're reading, like capturing things that you think are really good for the future? Or is that pretty much like, ooh, I'm reading this and this will go well with the sermon I know I'm doing in 3 weeks? Like, is that pretty short term, or do you have a long term system for that?
You know, I'm really bad with that. I do have a way of capturing things. I'm bad at finding where I put those things. So there are a lot of things that I lose in the process.
Sure.
Between reading a lot and not being as organized in that piece of my brain as I'd like to be. There are people in a meeting I was just in, there was someone that was, just said, well, remember, it was a year and a half ago. You read this chapter in this book and it had something. Why don't you use that? I'm like, there's no, I don't even remember when they even talked about it. And I was in the room when they did. So, you know, it is probably more, it's the stuff that's more recent. Prayerfully, it's the stuff that the Spirit brings. But I just kind of grab what I can grab.
And all the study you mentioned earlier, the For Everyone's and all that, are you a Bible software guy? Or are you pull the book off the shelf kind of guy?
I'm really not. I want to be. I'm a old school book guy, and I'm an obnoxious underliner. I mean, I underline things. I argue with the author in the margins. I make notes. You almost can't read a book after I have. It's just ridiculous. And I find that's just too difficult to interact with in software for me. I like the convenience of having a lot of things in something that weighs just over a pound. But if I'm really digging into something, I really like having the book.
Yeah, I understand that. Funny because I've been reading these articles about that. You know, people don't retain as much with ebooks and all that. And I think there's some truth to that. It's such a give and take because I love how easy I can capture my notes from an ebook. But I actually have, like, I just went back and reread Resident Aliens by Howard Wasson Willimon, which I had a paperback copy of because I first read it like 10 years ago. And I thought, there's something really good about reading this pen in hand and looking at my prior underlines, which my book was still readable. But looking at my prior underlines and making notes and seeing what I thought was important then and all that. So, yeah, there is something to be said for that. But, man, I don't have an office, so I sure like carrying things with me on the go. So it's a give and take.
That's a huge advantage. And honestly, the search function is a really, really great thing, especially for someone like me that can't remember what book it came from.
Yeah.
That is a huge advantage. I wish I could. I'm a little old school. Even the book when I was writing it, I wrote everything out longhand on a legal pad before I would even type it onto my laptop.
You're a regular Steinbeck, or
I know or... I am just as good as he is too. It was, but you know, I it's just kind of the way I work. I don't know. I'm sure it could shift if I worked at it hard enough, but I just don't have the motivation.
Yeah. Well, Todd, I mean, you've alluded to it twice, but I know not everybody who's listening to this probably be familiar. Talk a little bit, just briefly, about your book and the backstory of that.
Oh, yeah.
Briefly, of course. Yeah. Good luck with that.
Well, Jonathan. it's called Should We Fire God? And it was born out of a series of interviews that I did after the Virginia Tech shootings that we were here for, and obviously we were very directly affected by. And just the questions. I mean, there was this flurry of media interest that, I mean, we see now with the shooting in France. And when something happens, you kind of want to know, what's it like to be there? And it's not all bad. You kind of, you feel for what people are walking through. And so we had that descend on us. And through a series of events that Chris Backert was involved in, I became one of the people that was interviewed by a lot of different people. And so CNN ended up doing kind of a collection of my answers to questions about how could God allow something like this. And they felt like it was maybe worded a little differently or thought through maybe a little differently than some of the more classic discussions of evil and suffering and all of that. And then an editor saw that interview in Sicily. And at the airport, that's where if you want to watch CNN, go to the airport.
That's true. But you can't hear what they're saying.
Yeah. And approached me about the potential of doing a book. And eventually, I mean, probably a year later, that got to the point where I felt good about her. She felt good about me and wrote a proposal. And so it kind of deals in the area of again, the first third is kind of honoring the questions that we have, the sense that some people have that it's almost like God is running the universe like a, like a union boss. You know, he was here first, so he's in charge. And not necessarily doing it as well as a lot of people that are observing him would think they would do if they were in his position. And so it's valid to think some of those things. Then the second third is kind of dealing with some neurochemistry, gets into areas of sociology and looking at how we engage with questions like this and what God's take on this might be. Are we right about how we think he thinks about it? And then the last third gets into, okay, let's say God did exactly what we wanted him to do. What would that be like? And what are some of the ramifications? We often think of the things, if we could tell God, okay, eradicate this evil, that we think about the front of the list a lot. We don't tend to think about the end of the list or what God would have to do in us to make that list possible. And so it gets into that. So it's kind of a, it, you know, theodicy, evil, suffering. Some of those chapters were a little dark to kind of swim in for a few weeks when I was working on them.
Yeah, I bet. Especially when you have to handwrite them and then retype them. You got to read them
well,
twice.
Let me tell you. And then you edit and edit and edit, and then you reorganize the book, and then you edit and edit and edit. And the hardest thing was there's an audio book, and they had me read it. And for that, you go into this recording studio, and they just have your book on printed out 8.5 by 11 sheets, and you just read, and you have a guy in the sound booth that if you wrote "it is" and you read "it's," I'll say, "Mr. Pace, I'm sorry, can you go back?" And you know, and so you have to read precisely word for word everything that you wrote, probably at this point about 8 months to a year after you wrote it. And it was a miserable process. You know, there's things where you think, oh, I wish I would have said that. I wish I could have done that. You know, there's some parts that I still felt like, God, I think you spoke in that moment. But so it was really something. It was really something.
Yeah. I didn't even realize you'd done the audiobook. So
yeah,
here it is. I'm looking at it right now on audible.com.
There it is, man.
Well, since you are a big reader, are there other, I mean, you mentioned some of these, you mentioned your own book, but you mentioned some other books, but are there books that you feel like have been really helpful for forming you as a preacher or how you preach that you think are worth sharing?
There have been. I'm kind of a blend, in the books that I like to read on preaching and teaching. So I'll read, you know, I like some of Andy Stanley's thoughts on communication, but then I like The Art and Craft of Biblical Preaching is kind of a classic. Robinson and Larson, I think, and then Biblical Preaching by Larson. Those are really good. I love to read Agreedman's, I think, The Modern Preacher and the Ancient Text. And then I'll throw in some, you know, Ferguson, The Big Idea, just some things on how you just communicate effectively. I've read a number of books on neural processing and how the spoken word processes differently when you do this versus this versus this. And so those have been really helpful to me.
What are some of those?
Oh, gosh, man. That's a really good question. I'm totally blanking. In fact, I'm standing right now in front of my books trying to find where they are. I'm not seeing them right now. I'll either find them in the next minute or.
That's all right.
Yeah.
You can always send them to me and I can include them. So
there you go. Okay. I'll do that. I promise I've read them. It's like, yeah,
you're totally making this up.
But I don't know what they are.
Yeah, I read the entire explanation of how the universe was formed.
That's right. And then I wrote the answer to it, and but I can't remember what any of that stuff is.
Last year I read Church Dogmatics by Bart.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I promise.
Yeah, it took almost 3 weeks. So, right. Exactly.
Well, Jim, I know that we had to, this is about your wind down time, but it's been fun to talk to you. As I've said before with others, not with everyone, I'm kidding, but one of my favorite things about doing this is I have a lot of friends. I have a lot of friends.
It's nice to be able to say that, isn't it?
I have a lot of friends who are preachers, so it gives me a chance to talk with them and talk about something I love and talk to people I love. So that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. But thanks for your time. If anybody wants to keep up with what's going on in the life of your church or you, what are all your online things?
Oh, yes. I'm NLCF Jim on Twitter. When I tweet, which I am constantly razzed, is not very frequently. I think Facebook is honestly the easiest way. My blog is more is more neglected than Twitter is by me.
And that's jimpace.net. Am I remembering that?
Jimpace.net. Yes. Yeah. And so that's, you know, that gives some things that we've walked through over the last number of years. But yeah, it really, the easiest thing is through, I do a lot of, for the folks that we, focus on, Facebook is a pretty key thing. So yeah. I do that. Hey, I found one of the books. There it is. Rewiring Your Preaching, How the Brain Processes Sermons. Really good book.
Yeah.
Richard Cox. I hadn't heard of him before, but he goes into a lot of the, neural responses to the tendency just to kind of one to drone, but the tendency to just kind of speak in one voice, one way, with one type of approach. It was a very helpful book for me.
Good.
So that's one of them. There's others, but I'll never find them.
I'm excited about that though, because that's one I've
there you go.
That's one I've not heard of, and certainly has not been mentioned before. So.
There we go. Bursa bee.
That's like a B plus there.
Hey, all right, I'll take that.
Well, Jim, it's good to hear your voice.
Hey, it was really good to talk with you, John. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks for coming up.
All right.
Blessings.